Hey, kids.
You're listening to the internet's wettest podcast about video games, consoles,
and pancakes.
The SML Podcast.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I'm your host, Joe. We've got Purnell, Aki, and Chris Taylor here. How is everybody doing?
Sleepy, but well, which in this era, that's a good thing.
Sleepy, but well.
Yeah, because I'm going to bed when this is done, or I may just sacrifice sleep to waste more time. But I haven't decided yet. I just know I'm tired now.
I can agree with that. I am also tired, so... Sleep sounds good.
Uncharacteristically, I'm not as tired today because I was so tired that I called into work and then went back to bed. So now I've actually had some sleep. So I'm kind of like, all right.
Yeah, sleep and ravioli?
Yeah.
A good night.
Best of both worlds. Delicious.
So, Chris, how have you been? How's things going with you?
It's been going all right. It's like... just super busy at work, trying to do other stuff, but too busy for that stuff too. I did get a Saturn recently. Ooh. A Sega Saturn and a Saru flash cart. And
does it let you roll? Whoa, slow down there, AK. I got a question.
What?
So does that cart let you save games and store game data as well?
Yeah, it works as both, a RAM cart, but also, yes, you can just load games off of it from a micro SD card. So it's a flash card, essentially.
Yeah, I might need to get on that. I'm tired of my battery dying and killing all my data. Plus, when you have to do the swap cart to play games, it makes it kind of hard to store data on another cart. So that's looking real promising right now.
Yeah, it's good. It's I have an older Saturn, like the kind of launch model, so not every game works perfectly, but you know, it's one of those things where it's like you can fiddle with it and have stuff.
But the model makes a difference in that case?
Yeah, when it comes to the flash cart, sometimes they like what I needed to do, like for instance for House of the Dead, I needed to program in or add in a line of code to just kind of tell it to slow its roll on like loading the game data. Otherwise the audio ends up jacked up. And, there was a GitHub post thread that I was able to follow and told me the exact values to put in. And, you know, but for the most part, it's very plug and play. You just load in like, a bin and queue file for the game and then it just loads them right up. Even shows the cover art, the box art.
That is awesome.
Yeah, and also it plays translations, so I can now play through all three of the Shining Force 3 scenarios in English, which is what I really wanted it for.
That is literally why I was asking. I was playing mine, and I got, it's like maybe 25 hours into the first game, specifically because I kept grinding Railhead to get a perfect clear on that level, if you know what that is, or if not, you'll know soon.
I will know soon, because right now I'm working on Shining Force CD. I've been going through the whole series, and I haven't gotten to 3 yet, but I will, and I'm very much looking forward to it.
Is CD fun? Because that's the only one I haven't played that in the
I love it. It's the Game Gear games, so it's one of those, it's like, if you played like Sword of Haja or something like that, it doesn't have like walking around like the first two Shining Forces.
That's been my concern. Like, it's just battle after battle, no towns and stuff like that. And I was worried that would hurt it.
It doesn't. It actually, I mean, you know, it changes it somewhat, but it's like, I'm fine with it. It's, it's just battle after battle. I really like the characters. It zips by a little bit faster, but it's still got a lot in it. So, I'm in chapter 4 now. Out of I don't know how many, but I've been And that's just in book one. So there's like four books. So it's a lot of game.
I like the sound of that.
Yeah, and all of the the story is just told through cutscenes. So it's just like, instead of walking around town, you know, you just have a hub where when you use Egress, it takes you to the hub instead of a town, and then that's always got a shop in it, so you can always, and it's up, the shop is updated all the time.
And then you, characters, because no secret. Yeah,
well, actually, there are secret characters. I accidentally found one.
What, are they on the battle map or something?
Yeah, you have to search certain squares on the battle map. I went to this random patch of grass in one of the battles, and I found Domingo from the first game.
Ooh, he's a beast in that game, so hopefully that remains true.
He's missing his godlike defense, but he starts off with Blaze 3 and Freeze 3, so he's like, yeah, he's a marauder for sure.
Kind of reminds me a little of Vandal Hearts than having to go to specific tiles on the map for secrets.
Yeah, you know, it's fine. Like, there's, you know, if you don't, you don't need to do, like, to get all the secrets or anything if you don't want to. And, you know, there's guides for if you want to look ahead. But yeah, it was like a complete accident. I just went up to this grass and I was about to stay. You know, like you tell your units to stay, and it had a search instead of stay. And I was like, oh, okay, so there's something here. And it wasn't like off on the extreme side of the map, it was just like somewhere where I would just normally go anyway.
And it didn't even stand out like a patch of grass surrounded by like an eight tile a field or something.
I don't think so. No, it seemed like it was pretty normal.
Damn.
Yeah,
I'm gonna be thorough. But I'm sorry to derail the conversation. The important part is you got a Saturn, and Shining Force is cool.
Yeah, exactly.
I've been watching someone stream Panzer Dragoon Saga off of Saturn on Twitch lately.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that one, too. I love Panzer Dragoon, and I've always heard good things about Panzer Dragoon Saga.
He runs a game store, so he's cheating.
Oh, yeah. Well, the funny thing is, okay, so I posted on Blue Sky that, you know, I got the system, I got component cables and an adapter, I got, you know, so I can plug it into my stream setup where I can play it on both my CRT and my HDTV and stream at the same time.
Nice.
You know, I've got a new battery for it, I got two guns, I've got, because one of the games can actually utilize two guns, well, a few of them, and, I got, like, an OEM controller, two wireless controllers, and, you know, all this other stuff. And I was, like, in the Saru flash card, so with a 256 gigabyte, you know, card that I've completely filled up with every English-friendly game that is available. I said, all for the price of one physical Saturn game. And then somebody commented, physical games FTW. And I'm like, well, that's kind of... I mean, unless you're trolling, that's like opposite of what my point is here, is that Saturn physical games are extremely expensive and therefore inaccessible to anybody. So it doesn't have endless budget.
Yeah, I saw a few really expensive Saturn games at Too Many Games the other weekend.
Yeah.
Although I stand behind the idea.
The most expensive game I saw was Little Samson on NES.
Yeah, it's up there. That's one of the more pricey
$3,000, I think they had it priced at.
Good lord.
Yeah, I watched a guy buy it at PMG last year, but I didn't see the physical amount of money that transpired, so I got it again. And I was like, hey, out of curiosity, if you want to share, how much did he pay for that? And the guy was still standing there, and he was like, well, I can't say specifically, but I will say it was about a mortgage payment at least.
Oh, geez.
And I'm like, a mortgage payment? Like, oh, I must be on a big house based on the way you're talking. So, woof. In this economy, a mortgage payment?
Speaking of this economy, Purnell, I got a question for you.
Steam machine, have a mortgage payment. Yeah, I'm a sucker.
Tell us but about also, it.
I can. It's sitting on the floor in a box. I'm
you
playing
didn't
on the
hook
Steam
it
deck.
Up yet? What the?
Well, first of all, I'm tired. Second of all, it showed up on a day I worked from 8 to 8, and then I had dinner. So that wasn't happening. And three, I just haven't gotten around to it. I'm in no rush. I got the device. That was the hard part. Now I just got to make time for it eventually, and I will.
I don't, the first thing I would do if that showed up, I would immediately drop everything I was doing and hook it up.
First thing. I'm very much a weird guy. I mean, don't you remember how long it took me to set up a Switch when I got my first Switch? And
yeah,
that was when
real.
I didn't have a comparable device.
We kept.
I knew I wanted the Switch.
Busting your balls for that too.
Yeah, and I was like, you know, I'll get to it when I get to it. The important part is I got the thing that actually is hard to get. Once I get it, it's my time to set up when I want or when I make a moment for it. But I got.
What made you want it?
Because I want a Steam machine. Oh. All jokes aside, though, the reason why I wanted it was because even though it's not PS5 Pro power or whatever people are saying about it, it is still much more powerful than the Steam Deck. And the Steam Deck right now is my only method to play games off of Steam right now. So it was nice to have that as a TV option to play games that are potentially more powerful. Or, heaven forbid, I have a friend over and I want to do multiplayer and I have to hook the Steam Deck up to a dock and all that.
There
so, I'm just like, screw it. And the other part of it, believe it or not, is I didn't own a Steam controller. So for me, the Steam controller retails for $100 when they put it out on the market. And that was part of the cost of getting the Steam Deck with the controller. So to me, it was like, okay, I'm getting the thing that I already wanted to get but missed out on. And I want to get the Steam machine along with it. So in that regard, I was like, yeah, I'll just knock them all off in one swoop and just figure it out later. And as one guy said on Twitter, Instagram, if I don't like it, there's always Facebook Marketplace and people do want it, because I've been seeing people constantly post, oh, I haven't got my email yet, I'm still waiting for my confirmation email, we're all on the waiting list. So people do want them. So it's not, even though, you know, there's concern and issue about the cost of it, and to be fair, it's reasonably so, though I personally get why the cost is higher than it was originally intended to be. Doesn't change the fact that people do want the device. So, I'm good
Very
with
true.
It.
I was just curious, what made you want to pick that? Did you get the base one or the pro model, I guess I would call it, with the expanded memory?
What do you think? Come on.
I would hope you got the better one. Because if you're spending that much, you might as well go all out.
Not just that, but it's also just the general vibe that I prefer to have that memory space, and it's not as easy to replace anything in this thing as it was the Steam Deck. So I'm not going to just go out of my way to get another hard drive in there, though I think it does take micro SD. So I can expand with that too, if I should see fit later. But
I was just about to ask if it has expandable memory.
I recall it being having a micro SD
slot. We could ask you about it and get your opinions on it.
Yeah,
so
I know.
I'm excited to ask you about that tonight. You're like, it's in the box. The box looks awesome.
Isn't that a cool question? I mean, that's the answer. Like, how is it?
Words
it's
on the box.
It's got the box had my address
on the box.
On it. It had battery warning, flammable on the box. But thankfully, it's not a very nondescript box. If you didn't know that Valve was located in Carroll Stream, or that Valve made Steam machines, you wouldn't know that this was a Steam machine. Short of, you know, picking the thing up and reading the address label. But the boxes have like Valve printed on the side, which I'm trying to remember what company it was that did that recently, where they sent all the machines out. I think it was even like a PS5, maybe someone talked about. They shipped the PS5 to them. It showed up at their house, not in packaging. It just had a shipping label on the side of the PlayStation's actual box sitting on their step in front of their house. Jesus. Like, yeah, that's cool. So I was just going, oh boy, free digs. But, I'm pretty sure once I hook it up, I'll be happy to have it and I'll put it to use. Like, hell, the Steam Deck, you know how much I use it. You know how long it took me to open the Steam Deck up? I think it was like a week or two. It was like 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And then I finally said, you know, I got a minute. Let me just set the Steam Deck up. And it's like, ooh, this thing is cool. So,
I should have done this 2 weeks ago.
Well, I mean, it was still fun. I mean, the important part was the time was right. I engaged when the time was right, and I enjoyed the results.
That's the important part, enjoying your results.
That's right. And also eating canned soups to buy the time back, because that thing was not cheap. Woof.
Yeah, that's a pricey little bastard.
Yeah. And I mean, real quick to mention like general cost aspects of things that came up while looking at Game Machine. So like maybe let's say 2 months ago, I don't know why, probably thinking about, you know, getting a more powerful device in general. I was like, oh, I like my Steam Machine or Steam Machine, my Steam Deck, but it'd be nice to get one. Check out that Xbox Ally X or whatever, which was like supposedly like the most powerful of the portable PC game devices. And I went to look online, retails for $2,000. I go, what? Wait, is that how much it always costs? No, it retailed originally for like $1,000. Now it sells for $2,000. And that's retail, wow, not secondhand market. So shit got pricey. Everything went up. So this thing, I'm like, after seeing and everything, oh no, it was like $1,300 or whatever this thing was. Like the Legion GOAT jammed up by $1,000, or the Xbox Ally X went up $1,000. I'm okay with this going up a couple hundred.
Ally X is only $1,000. The Legion GO is $2,000.
Maybe that's what I was looking at. Maybe it was the Legion GO. Yeah. The Legion GO 2 or something. But that was originally $1,000, and now it's $2,000. Sorry about that.
Yeah, the Ally X is still chilling at $1,000.
Oh, okay. So
or $600 for the cheaper one.
Regarding the name of the Xbox Ally X, and replace it all with Legion GO 2 or whatever it was called. The model, I think, was the 2. But
yeah,
it was like, oh, I'm not buying that. Screw you. Steam Deck it is. So, but now I'm comfortable having the best of both worlds. I got a Steam Deck for portable play and lying around. And if I want to sit down on the couch and play something on the TV, I can use the Steam Machine and play more powerful stuff. But if I want to go somewhere and have it available for the TV, I'll take the Steam Dock along with the Steam Deck and play it there, which is odd because we're literally having a discussion about, you know, physical games and stuff earlier. And I think where I fall on it, like people will go, well, why? And I wonder how Chris feels about this statement, too, actually, because he's also a very pro physical guy. There's the idea that people will say, well, if you're so pro physical, why do you buy so much shit on Steam? Yeah, checkmate, bitch. And I'm like, well, here's the thing. I get stuff on Steam for peanuts. I don't pay console prices and physical game prices for games on Steam. I get dirt cheap games on Steam. And as a result of that, as dumb as it may sound, there's a small part of me that feels a little less concerned if something happens to a game on there versus if I buy a game that's retailing for $60, $80 or whatever, I want a tangible good if I can get it. So I prefer the tangible good.
Yeah. I mean, my thought on that is that there's just different people that have different needs when it comes to gaming. And so, like, you've got your folks who they just want a thing, a hub for video games. They want everything on it, you know, and they just want to play at home. And like, it's, you know, for that, it's like, yeah, a computer with Steam on it, that's fine. And you know, that, like I said, yeah, you get your stuff cheaper usually. You know, if you're into stuff like modding, which I'm not, then, you know, that's your thing you can do there too. If you go with like Switch 2, it's like, well, for one, you like Nintendo first party stuff, cause that's the only place you can get those, you know, without, you know, pirating or whatever. Which, you know, one would never do. But your Switch has like, you know, a really good selection of games, like, you know, and you do get some really cheap stuff on there too. I mean, the sales are outstanding sometimes. And well, except for, again, the Nintendo first party stuff. Yeah. And it's like, it's both portable and, you know, I like that it's portable and, you know, you can plug into the TV and, you know, recently I actually really like the game lending feature as well. I think that's really cool. Since I live with somebody who also has a Switch 2 and doesn't have the huge amount of games I have, it's like I can be like, hey, you can have this for, you know, a while and try it out.
And can you only and then, lend, you know, one at a time?
How I think so. Work? Well, okay. I don't really know. I haven't tried to lend out more than one.
Because I've never had to use that feature at all, because it's just me living here with the Switch. Ashley doesn't have her own.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I haven't tried it extensively. I'm just saying that's a feature of it. And, yeah. But, like, and then, you know, presumably, the kind of, you know, the other Venn diagram are people who are, you know, and this isn't necessarily old school, because there's a lot of, like, I'm seeing Gen Z and, like, even younger, like, gamers who are getting into, like, you know, physical games, because it's like everything is so digital now, and, like, there's so few things that, you know, people just like building a little library. They like having the games right there. You don't need the internet to use them. You know, it's just, it's all right there on the media, and just having it on the shelf is, like, a thing that people really like. And, like I said, it's future-proof in that as long as the system works, then the game will work.
As long as the game doesn't erode, which, funny enough, I somehow dodged that whole 15-year CD melting thing.
My Nintendo tapes, in fact, my Atari 2600 games are all still working, so I don't know. It's that stuff will probably rot away, but it's like, there's other yo-ho-ho solutions for if that happens.
CDs were only thought to have like a 15-year shelf life before they deteriorated.
Yeah,
and I have purchased CDs like for a computer that have had like the degradation, but thankfully, for better or worse, none of my actual purchased console games have experienced that yet.
And when you get to a certain,
burned me when I was a junior in high school that still plays.
Nice. Yeah, I have some CDI games that are burned on CD that still play. But anyways,
legal backups, of course.
Yeah, of course. Well, like I said, and there's, you know, there's the other way that they're future proofed is that technology advances so much by the time that you get that far away from when that stuff was like current and relevant, that, you know, you can do something like, you know, have a full Saturn library on a cart, you know, and those are all CD based games originally, but, you know, I got them and they play on a Saturn. It's like, it's great. So anyway,
to be honest, that's largely why, I won't ramble. I was going to go on a whole other dialogue, but that's another thing. What were you saying, Chris?
So you got the people who like have the library mentality. They want the physical games. They want to have a game that's right there on the shelf, put it in your system and it works. And like, that's, you know, great. So with the whole, and like, you know, most gamers are in the middle of that Venn diagram, right? Like they're, you know, everything has some kind of use. Like, I would not want a physical stack of the games I have on Steam around. I would not want that.
No. You're here to vet.
I have 1,500 games on stream right now. My two or three, four. I can't tell. Racks full of 360 games.
Yeah.
I have way too many.
I have a total of 1,500 something Switch games and 8 Switch 2 games. No, I have a lot of Switch 2 games that are downloaded, but like my physical collection is just like about 250 Switch games and 8 Switch 2 games. And like those fit on the shelf just fine, but I wouldn't want all of the 1,500 to be physical games. Yeah. It's like, I don't want that.
I would cry if my Xbox library were entirely physical. My Xbox library is a Dragon Ball joke right now.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's practical limits to what you can have, like, in terms of physical games, but if you take them away, like if we're talking about that as a scenario, I assume that's what the original question was about. If you take them away, it's like that won't stop video games from being played, but it will make some things like just redundant, like Xbox and PlayStation 5 or whatever, like, and PC. If the games are coming out on all three, why do you have all three? You know, like, what are you doing? Switch will be fine because it has a special function and a, you know, specific set of, like, you know, exclusives from, you know, first party.
What's the special skill? You're talking about the docking and all that, or?
Yeah, the docking. And, you know, it has other features too, but, like, you know, the things that Switch 2 has, like, that PlayStation and Xbox do not have because they're, you know, essentially, like, computers
in a box.
Yeah, they're, and that's the thing that's good about them is that they are, you buy the box, you plug it into your TV, you know, the games that have that PS5 on them will work. Like, you don't always know that with computers. So like, that's the thrill of consoles. But yeah, like, removing physical games from the consoles you're just kind of like, you just have another computer now that just does the Steam thing. And it's like,
and now that the way Steam works, where half the time, like, I used to have that issue where, like, man, but what if it doesn't work? Yada, yada, yada. But for the most part, with Steam OS, and now with Steam Deck itself being as popular as it is, and they do a general rating system, even if the game doesn't make the rating, it out the box, typically,
yeah,
a game will work on there. Like, I've gotten review games for this show that went right to Steam Deck, and the thing on the system says currently unsupported. Like, well, it's still working, so whatever. Like, it just works. Like, I don't have to do the stuff I used to do back when I had my old PC to play games anymore. I'm sure some people do when they want the, you know, peak performance and whatnot, but sitting here with this little box, everything works for the most part.
Yeah. And another aspect of it that I just wanted to briefly touch on is, you know, having grown up poor out in the country, is that, you know, some people just don't have access to the high-speed internet to download everything, like, on their system. So it's like,
that's for a long time, I was staunchly against non-physical media, and that was specifically why. That was even when I started this show. I was still very anti-digital because my internet was shit. Every single game I got on here would take me like an entire day of just downloading just that one game, not using my internet for anything the fuck else, because my internet was so shit.
Yeah, so, like, you know, unless high-speed broadband internet becomes an accessible, like, you know, what would you call it, like a utility in this country instead of a for-sale service, then, you know, that's just not going to work for everybody. And so having the physical option is, and, you know, that's against Switch 2 as well with their game key cards and stuff. It's like, you know, I get the purpose of them, but, you know, and that's fine. That's a whole different argument. But, like, yeah, you know, for people who can't download, at least have something that, you know, that you can do. But, or, you know, like I said, as far as that goes, I think there's just different people with different needs, and I think that things are fine. You know, as long as everybody has an option to do something, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because
you take away options and people are just not going to give you money.
Money!
Yeah, pretty much.
Hey, we have a Horaclite joining. How are you doing?
I wasn't going to join for this part, but then guys started talking about physical stuff, and I was like,
Somebody say, let's get physical.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of physical games.
I'm a fan of having space for them.
Oh yeah, I still have a problem with space. I keep buying them though, but I shouldn't sometimes.
That's my painful situation here too. Buy my first home, thinking I got more space than I'll ever use, and that changed. That changed fast.
Well, for me at least, like, I collect a lot of Switch games, even though I don't own the console. So what I'll do for majority of them is I'll get it on digitally on Xbox or PlayStation, and then I'll have the physical and the Switch version for a lot of them.
Wait, we're talking Switch 1 or Switch 2?
Switch 1. I'm still... Sorry?
I was going to say, if it's not TMI, why don't you have a Switch 1 yet?
For the same reason that I have a TurboGrafx, Sega Saturn, and, like, Sega CD that I've never played, I own a handful of games for all those. I just, you know, finding the time. I just always liked collecting games, so.
That I can understand. There's something about the idea of collecting things.
Yeah, I like having a physical library of, you know, well, any type of media, really, or, you know, like comics or something like that. And then... as a form of like preservation too, for like a number of games, like there's some games I'd always want to have access to play at some point, regardless of the platform. So like just having an extra physical option for that is nice. You know, if there is like license, I doubt for most of the games, the licenses will be revoked ever, but you never know. There's some games that happens too. So that's like a nightmare scenario.
Yeah.
Just get removed from your digital library with no reason.
Don't get me started on that.
No. Well, thankfully, there haven't been too many games that have been fully hard delisted. Out of thousands of games, it's only, what, a few dozen if that.
I suppose.
Yeah, it's pretty minimal.
It's more than there should be, but...
Well, you never know. Like, even there was a new game recently. It wasn't hard delisted, but, like, the game Mouthhole, I was, like, playing that not too long ago digitally. And it was funny because I was telling people they could buy it on Steam at the time when I was playing it. And then I looked it up and it was like, oh, no, it's actually delisted from Steam. And I was like, oh, man. So, but there's a physical for that that just came out semi recently. So, you know, that you could still play it on PS5. It's not delisted from that yet. But like if that happened on PS5, like that physical would be the only way to play that on that console at that point. So that's the good thing about physical.
Fun.
Yeah. So, I like I like a mix. I have like a huge physical collection of everything, but I have so much more that's just, you know, on flash carts or, you know, hard drives or, you know, memory cards and whatnot. So, but I still like being surrounded by these pieces of plastic that, you know.
To be honest, that's a large part of what always floors me about even like the idea of Joe mentioned TMG earlier. That's one thing that seems to floor me about that in the first place, is the fact that in this age, like, I have all the games I bought growing up, and I'm happy to have access to those things and use them. And beyond that, I always find myself thinking, if I need to get an old game at this point, I'm just going to get a ROM and play it that way. But the fact that collector's games still come out, they still sell for as much as they do at those cons, despite the fact that you could likely just play the game, you know, in an easier fashion, and you're not really taking money out of the mouths of companies because the company's already got their money from when they originally came out. It's an interesting thought there. It was like, this market still very much thrives in that manner. And while someone might say, yeah, but physical means you technically own it, I feel like in the context of where you are going back to certain game consoles, emulation has gotten so well done, and it's so easy to access the things that it may as well be owning them.
Yeah, and the other thing I like is, again, Nintendo's thing of, like, making, you know, the Switch Online stuff. So it's like, they'll drop games into there, like they just did about an hour ago. And it's funny because, like, I guess it must be, like,
what did they drop this week?
On Game Boy, Wario Land, Super Mario Land 3, which is great because they already had Wario Land 3 on there. Sword of Hope 2, which is great because they had Sword of Hope, and Fortified Zone.
Yeah, interesting.
Jellico, yeah, game. And then on the Game Boy Advance, I'm very excited about this, the Dr. Mario and Puzzle League game.
Ooh.
Which is a great version of Dr. Mario, but it's, yeah, the Puzzle League is like the most current version of the Tetris Attack Panel de Pon type of game.
It's Pokemon Puzzle League?
Yeah, but without any characters. There's no Pokemon, there's no Yoshi's Island characters. It's just straight up, here's the puzzle swapping
puzzle
game.
Puzzle blocks.
Yeah. I love that they released a 2-in-1 cartridge as well, like in the virtual thing. I mean, that's the only way it was ever sold, but it's like, it's just funny to me. But yeah, I love Dr. Mario Puzzle League. Like, I burnt so many hours on that. Both games, in fact. I got pretty good at Dr. Mario playing that. But yeah, I got excited about those, even though I physically own all of those games except for Fortified Zone, and I have them on at least 7 different types of FPGA or emulation or, you know, whatever. It's like, I have those games over and over and over again, and yet I got those downloaded on my Switch, and I felt that little tinge of, oh boy, new games! So...
And I do like that about the Nintendo system, just Nintendo store in that regard. Like, even if you're like emulator station or whatever, sometimes it's nice to come across a game on there like, oh, I didn't know that existed. And yeah, there's a game they put on there, so I could check this out and use your subscription service to give it a go.
Or sometimes just because it's there, you'll be like, don't mind if I do. And then you just like, you know, play through it. Well, you might not if it's just on a, you know, a text list of, you know, video games, or, you know, buried in your very handsome Game Boy shelf. I have these little hobby drawers that are like for, you know, people who like to store knickknacks, and they sell them at the Container Store, and they're the exact perfect size and dimension to hold Game Boy games and Game Boy Advance, but But like they're the perfect like width and height that they're just these little plastic drawers and they hold all my Game Boy games.
Nice.
I was all about the Altoids tins for DS games.
Oh yeah,
those now. I kept my old cases. That, I always get freaked out when I go to like a used game shop or go to one of those conventions. It's like, here's the loose card. I'm like, no, they had perfect clamshells. I need the clamshell. I don't want the little loosey thing. I remember buying one of the few from DS games I was missing at a time. I was like, oh, I can get it off of, I think it was either eBay or off of Amazon. I can't remember which of the two, but it was Mario versus Donkey Kong 3. And I bought that, and it showed up in the mail, and it was just the cart. And I was like, the fuck is this? I didn't order this. I ordered the full game. I was irrationally upset about the fact that I just had a cart mailed to me. Like, it just didn't feel right.
Yeah, it sucks. If you buy used, you never know what you're getting from GameStop. There's a couple of 360 games I had my eye on because they were doing a buy two, get one free sale. And if I bought three of them, they would average out to like $30 each when they're like normally $60 each.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to risk ordering three games and getting three disc onlys. Like, you don't know what you're getting. You'll find out when it arrives in the mail.
Like a box of chocolate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. Oh, yeah. One of the main reasons that I loved physical collecting was because I did a lot of it as like a hunting kind of thing. So like, you know, just going around the like city or like surrounding cities and like perusing, you know, used shops and pawn shops and stuff like that, and just like stumbling across games like I had never seen before. It was always like really fun time, like garage sales on occasion, although I kind of phased out of that after a while. But like, you never know. Like, a good example is like I found Condemned Criminal Origins like back in the day for like $2, and like, nice. I'd never heard of that game previously, and I played that because I saw it for $2 at a garage sale, and it's like, oh man, this game is fucking awesome.
Oh, this is good too, boy. Ooh.
Yeah, I'd never heard of that game previously, and I know there's been like a ton of physical games like that, and then even for games that like are retro ones that get modern ports, like semi recently was that Platypus Reclaid game I played. Like, I'd never seen that game before, and then when I played it for the show, and then I learned it had a PSP physical, I'm like, oh man, the game's awesome! Like, I wish I had stumbled across that, but yeah, that, for me, that was always a big part of physical collecting, was just kind of finding and seeking out the games or like stumbling across them at random places, but. Now, if that goes away, then, like, I'm sure usually you can have that happen digitally, too, but, like, there's some games that are just kind of fade into the void because people just don't talk about them enough, so it's easy to, like, look past stuff online because there's so many games available digitally, especially for Steam, not even including, like, Itch and, like, other digital platforms. But, so, yeah, that's a good example. If you like a game, talk about it more online, especially if it's obscure.
Mm-hmm. Which reminds me of
games we gotta talk about. What for now?
Now, I was like, speaking of which, anybody want to talk about that game, Stretch Panic?
No, but we got five games we can talk about.
Are they Stretch Panic?
No, they're not.
I want a re-release, damn it.
I don't know, Stretch Panic.
Oh, it was good. It was better than it had any right to be given. That was pretty much a tech demo for PlayStation 2. But it was a treasure game where you play as a little girl who had a scarf that could stretch the environment, and everything was stretchable. And it was basically a series of boss battles where you had to fight her cursed sisters. It was a lot of fun, but it could stand to getting more development time and have like more involved stages and puzzles and stuff.
Hey, this is a new game.
No. I was riffing on your comment about go online and talk about old, like those old favorites.
get the oh, I never heard of that
by
one.
The way, how about Stretch Panic?
I've heard of Panic Restaurant.
Oh, yeah. That was a good one, too. Flipping sausage with your pan.
My favorite PS2 game was Guitaru Man.
And that one got re-released, so clearly people were talking about it.
I'm still amazed at that. But, we got review games we got to tackle. Are you guys ready to dive into these?
Or is it one of them Guitaru Man?
No, none are. You're like turning into Jacob with your questions tonight.
Papa the Rapa.
One of those days. My main character
always got remastered.
I do always myself want to know the status of Gitaru Man, if it has changed at all.
He's still a Gitaru Man.
He's still Gitaru Man. All right, we got reviews. First game to talk about tonight, R-Type Tactics 1 and 2 Cosmos, developed by Granzella, published by NIS America. Released June 18th, Xbox Series X and S, Switch, Switch 2, PS4, PS5, PC, $49.99. Turn tactical, turn-based strategy on its side in R-Type Tactics 1 and 2 Cosmos. Making its debut on modern consoles, this collection of two games comes with revamped visuals, multiple campaigns, and branching missions. Pernell, tell us about your time with R-Type Tactics 1 and 2 Cosmos.
So, R-Type Tactics 1 and 2 Cosmos, what a name, is actually three games in one box, though you can't play them all right off the box. You have to get to them as time progresses throughout your experience. But you get R-Type 1, R-Type 2, and Cosmos. Those are actually three different games existing within, but they all have the same general systems involved. So, conveniently, you can discuss it in that manner, in the sense of it being a tactical strategy game that uses my favorite style of gameplay when it comes to a tactical game, hex grid based movement. If you're familiar with the R-Type franchise, or to be more specific, if you're intimately familiar with the R-Type franchise, you have a lot to love here right out the box. But if you're casually familiar with R-Type, like myself, the game's still interesting, and yet you'll still be like, what the hell? I didn't know there was more than one type of force. I thought it was just the one that was on the box cover of all the R-Type games. But I digress. So the general scope of this game is that you're engaging with a conflict between the main forces of the humans and then the Bido, which is like a sort of alien sentient race or species that is basically trying to attack and invade and conquer Earth. There's some periods later in the game where that will potentially switch halves and you'll actually play as the other force versus the humans. But even still, what will change is basically the types of ships you have access to and their abilities. So what ends up happening at the outset is that you will be on a main screen. You choose a mission, and the mission will give you aspects of, you know, the map layout and the overall goal of the mission. And then it'll give you the ability to kind of do a slight preview of a level. And then once you're comfortable, you go into the level and you will load it out. Notice how I didn't mention anything about a tutorial before mentioning that. And that's because this game doesn't really have a tutorial. It has an introductory mission that explains the bare minimum. And then it just kind of expects you to feel lucky and get lucky to figure it all out on your own. There is, fortunately, a manual. Remember the days when you had manuals and you had to read those to learn how a game worked? Well, you will probably end up wanting to use the manual that's contained in this game in the game itself, because there were elements of the game that I was kind of fumbling through before I ended up opening the manual and reading it and discovering what the hell they meant and what I was supposed to be doing. But either way, you get tasked with going on a level. You pick the units that you want to actually send onto the map. Units can have actual pilots to them, too. And the pilots matter because you will actually get stat bumps if you manage to use, I guess, like commanders who have engaged in multiple battles to pilot ships. So, and also you want them to survive the battle. If you die or your ship gets blown up while the pilot's in it, you take penalties for that. Now, with that said, you load your units up, put them on the map, boom, it's time to go. Turn-based tactics. And HP of the units is either the total number of units a la Advanced Wars, so 10 out of 10, 9 out of 8, sometimes you get knocked somebody down, or it'll be an HP gauge if it's a singular unit that has an actual durability associated with it. Each unit has its own set of attacks that engage based on range of movement or field away from your character. There's different purpose for units. Like there's like, I'm freaking tired today. Let me start this up right.
Dude, there we all are. It's one of those weekends.
It's killing me. You have specific types of units that perform specific functions, such as fog of war type units, where they have a larger range of vision than other units, and they have mobility, so you want to send them out to get a lay of the land and see if you can catch enemies in the act before they get the drop on you. You have units that are designed to resupply units with ammunition or fuel, because in this game, your ships can run out of fuel in space and blow up. Same with, you know, armaments. there are some ships that have armaments that have infinite or a stupid amount of ammo, but they are weak, and you never want to rely on those if you can help it. You will have moments where you want to take over facilities, because by taking over facilities using liberation, you can actually send units on the field to those stations to re-up and supply without having to have the mobile unit to take care of that. There's mining resources, where you can actually go about the process of mining for ore, which is ultimately used at the end of a level to produce and build new units based on schematics you find throughout various plays as rewards for beating levels. There's a lot of depth that goes in this game, too, because the battles can be pretty lengthy, and the skirmishes themselves can be quite large as far as the number of units on the screen battling it out, and the stakes involved in that situation, like large bosses and such. And it's funny, too, because when I started playing it, it originally felt extremely dry to me. Like, it didn't have, like, you know, a pulse-pumping OST. I wasn't really feeling like I was getting thrown into the action. It was very much like low-key Space Jams. And like this little template character saying, like, okay, Captain, your order is just like a person that's just there to give you some, you know, personality in the game. But as I started to engage with it further, I started noticing the tactical depth that's associated with it. And to be blunt, it's actually pretty friggin' awesome. The only real downside I could think of to this is that I mentioned earlier, the levels themselves can be pretty big and the missions themselves can be pretty lengthy. Both due to the missions themselves and also just giving commands to every individual unit every round. And last but not least, it can be lengthy because the game in some respects has elements of grind to it, because you need resources to produce units and you need to actually have the blueprints for the ship's units to build that type of unit. So you'll be doing levels to get more, you know, materials to build new units in the event you start running out of units or you need different things. So don't be surprised if you find yourself replaying old missions to gain access to the resources needed to build that ship you unlocked that you really want to play with. But all that is to say is that you basically want to have a modicum of patience if you want to get in this game. Though, to be fair, they do have a save anywhere feature. You can save during combat and come back later. When you redo a mission after failure, you still get to keep the resources you acquired during the mission. So that's not a bad thing either. It's surprisingly fun, in that it's more fun than I expected to be given the initial base level dryness. And there's a stupid amount of content associated with this game. So when you do pick it up, if you want to exceed all this content or utilize all this content, you will be playing for well more than the cost of entry permits you will make you think you would.
Very good.
Your cute show.
Well, it clocks in at $50, and props to NIS for releasing this one on Xbox. Thank you. $50, what do you think of this one?
It's a buy it recommendation. I think this game is legitimately good. And for someone, folks like myself, as we were talking about physical games earlier, I think I largely ignored R-Type tactics on the PSP back in the day. And I am sad about that, because I missed out on a clearly fun game, but I'm remedying that right now.
Yay! All right, next up, Devil May Cry 5 Devil Hunter Edition, developed, published, and provided to us for this coverage by Capcom. Thank you, Capcom. Chris, say thank you.
Thank you, Capcom.
Released June 23rd on the Switch 2 for $39.99 and on sale until the 31st for $29.99. With its signature blend of high-octane action and otherworldly characters, Devil May Cry 5 Devil Hunter Edition harnesses the latest Capcom gaming tech to deliver graphically groundbreaking action-adventure masterpiece at 60 frames per second in both TV and handheld modes. Chris, this is your first foray in Devil May Cry, correct?
Yeah.
Tell us about your time with DMC5.
Okay, well, it's been really good. I do have some experience with Capcom games, and in fact, one of the things, besides, like, you know, like a combo base beat 'em up that this reminded me of a little bit, was Mega Man Legends, actually, because it kind of has, you know, the whole thing of, like, you know, you run around in kind of limited areas and, you know, blast enemies and then go to your hub and then, like, purchase all kinds of upgrades and things like that. And that's kind of like what this is. But yeah, so story-wise, well, I guess I'll back up a little bit. So yeah, this for those who don't know, this is you know, Devil May Cry 5 was actually released about 6 years ago for everything except Nintendo system, because, you know, it was a heavy duty game, and, you know, Switch 1 was a little behind on some of that stuff. So, you know, this is the latest in the series to arrive on Switch 2, because, like, the I think 1, 2, and 3 are available also on the eShop, so no 4 yet, but I mean, I guess that one's also kind of recent. But anyways, so yeah, it's a it's kind of confusing in terms of, like, the characters and stuff if you don't know the series already. I kind of ran into this same situation when I tried Trails of Cold Steel 4 before I tried 1, 2, and 3. In that, you know, it has all these characters and mentions all these other characters that are, like, you know, all from the series, and you're kind of like, huh? Because you're like, oh, this is Devil May Cry. This is the one that's got that guy called Dante, yeah? And he's got white hair and a big sword, and, like, you know, you start the game, and your beginning playable character is Nero, who is a smarmy guy with white hair and a big sword. It's like, oh. And yeah, it, you know, it has a little film in it that, like, kind of tells you about the series so far. And it kind of catches you up a little bit on the story in a very stylized way. But, you know, it kind of gives you, like, I guess the rundown of who the characters are, if we know, because apparently we don't know that much about the character V, who is in here. But yeah, the game has you playing as everybody. Eventually, like I said, the first few missions involve Nero, whom we could call we could call him Deadweight, because in the prologue, Dante is facing off against the Yuri Zen, who's the, I guess, the big bad, and because this is like a, I guess it's like a final battle, and then they turn the clock back to so that the rest of the game is going on. But yeah, he, like, calls Nero Deadweight, and Nero's like, I can't believe he called me Deadweight. And apparently that's what fans call him now.
Love it.
Yeah. So you play through the first few stages as Nero, who, by the way, I found very lovable. And also, I like that he is in the grand tradition of Capcom action characters who only has one arm, and the other arm is, like, a utility arm. So, you know, see also Mega Man and Bionic Commando, both of which have are kind of in this character in certain ways, especially Mega Man, because you literally, this being a Capcom game, you can literally buy the Mega Buster and give it to him. And the, you know, I have a slight complaint about that, though, in a second. But anyways, you also, after that, play as the character V, who looks like he is, he looks like a younger, gothier Adam, brother of Adam Driver. And he acts
That's
like...
That's what I thought, too. I was like, he just looks like a twinkier Kylo Ren.
Yeah, exactly correct. Like, yeah, you know, he's got the long coat and the, you know, he actually surfs on a black cloud, but, like, it's kind of like the way it operates is like a skateboard. And he his method of attacking is interesting. Instead of fighting the enemies directly, he kind of plays a game of Shining Force with them. In that he sends, you can send familiars to, like, weaken the enemies, and then he always has the last move. You know, it's like you're building up your hero character in Shining Force, but you never send him out, because if he dies, it's game over. You gotta eat up those experience points. Shining Force fans will know what I'm saying. But yeah, and then you also have, of course, the man himself, Dante, who you play much later in the game than I thought you would. And then there's a whole separate kind of storyline and missions having to do with Virgil, who is explained in the movie, the story so far movie, as being, I guess, Dante's twin brother, who I don't know, I I can't follow, like, without actually playing through the other games myself. It's like they do say what's going on with these characters, but it's like you just kind of shrug through it. But he's another badass with a sword and white hair, and, you know, maybe a little less smarmy. I don't know. Maybe they're all smarmy. I can't tell. Except V, he's very edgelordy. he's got this book that he reads from. Anyways, so yeah, you just play through as all of them, and like I said, the game just takes you through different scenes where then it closes them off, sends a bunch of enemies after you, you fight the enemies, and then eventually come to a boss. Now, the thing about the whole Devil May Cry series, it's not just a beat-em-up in that you're just getting rid of the enemies and moving on. Your whole thing is to kind of load up your character with all the stuff they need, including like combos, skills that you pay red orbs to learn. Red orbs are the currency that's dropped by enemies, kind of like the lunch money in River City Ransom. And like River City Ransom, you know, you buy these combos and special moves and stuff, and kind of learn how to use them. Like, the game even provides you with the Void, which is just a big old practice room for, like, you know, just like Street Fighter 4, I think it was, that just lets you, you know, sit in a room and practice your special moves and stuff, which you will need to, because there's like a billion zillion of them. And as you're fighting, the game awards you the style points, and style points means you get more red orbs. You know, your style ranks from D for dismal to, I think, triple S. I don't think it goes above triple S, but that's also very silly. And the game really revels in its silliness. I would say this game is much more silly than it is serious as a thing, which, again, that's very Capcom. In fact, my favorite character is, in fact, the role of the game, you know, like role in the Mega Man series. And her name is Nico, and she drives the van. And at first I was like, okay, so she's like Roll, but with a smoking problem. You know, she's like chain smoking cigarettes all the time. And, you know, she invents all the stuff for your hero to use. But when you find, the thing is, in the game, if you find a payphone, you can call her up, and then she'll show up in the van immediately. And the game just goes like, more and more absurd as to how she's going to show up in that van, this invincible van with the neon sign on the side of it. But yeah, the game is like really into its style and absurdity, and that's going to be the big draw for it for you. It's like, you know, it's as challenging as you want it to be. Certainly it's got a super hard mode, the Dante Must Die mode, and you know. And it also, like, has a very friendly, like, what they call a human mode, where, yeah, it's like, yeah, exactly, me too. I mean, for now, I always save the higher difficulty for after I've played it a few times, and then I'm like, all right, now I'm going to actually challenge myself. But I always just want to see the story first. But yeah, this game has so many, like, you know, jokes kind of hidden amongst the everything. It's got, like, the opening cinematic is, like, really, really fun. Will kind of remind you of Deadpool a little bit. People will know what I mean when they see it. And it even has, like, run-by visual gags where I had to, like, you know, what I love about the Switch is that, of course, you can just hit that record button and it tracks back 30 seconds, and so I can pause it and, like, actually see what I missed. And yeah, there's, like, some great stuff that you can just miss if you blink. And so yeah, this game was made with a lot of love. I did take a little bit of time to, like, kind of look at people's opinions of it, like series fans versus the other games, and this one does rank really high. If not everybody's favorite, then it's, you know, it's very close to it. So yeah, this is a very beloved game. And oh, and I haven't even mentioned the boss fights. The boss fights are, like, crazy. Bosses are generally either really huge or really cool looking. They'll very much remind you of, like, a Dark Souls series kind of boss. And yes, you do have a dodge roll. It's not just, you know, it's a special move like anything else, so it's not like you have to use it. Plus, you do have a jump that actually works pretty well, depending on the character. And, you know, it's not all about, you know, it's not like they use one move and you're dead. It's like, you know, these really are brawls, but it's like, I did enjoy when I saw the dodge roll that I was like, oh, we got one of those, huh? But yeah, the bosses are really something to behold, and they're very fun to do. So, yeah, I really like that. I was not expecting, really, getting into this series, that this would remind me so much of, like, Mega Man instead of, like, Final Fight, I don't know, or something else that's, like, in the beat-em-up genre. It really is, like, a learning about the different moves that you unlock throughout the game, and, like, the different weapons and stuff, and using them to take down enemies in, like, a way that's best for you. And, you know, to kind of experiment with all of it, so... Yeah, I really like that about it, and this is a... Even though I was a little confused by the story, it's like, I still feel like this is a good entry into the series for a total noob as myself.
All yeah, right, this, well, that one accumulates the story in a way that's, like, combining pretty much everything from the past games, so it's it's a little awkward to be the first one, story-wise.
Yeah, yeah. They definitely don't spoon-feed you this stuff. They're just like, here's everything. Enjoy.
Yep.
Well, sounds like you did enjoy it. It clocks in at $40. If you buy it before the end of this month, you have all month long. It is $30, but for $40 full price, what do you think of Devil May Cry 5?
Oh yeah, it's absolutely worth it. I mean, if you're a Nintendo person, then you know you haven't had access to this game in 6 years. So, and you know, it does. Sadly, I did not get a great sense of what is extra about this version versus the other versions, but that information is available. And there's certainly like a ton of stuff that's unlocked. Like, for instance, the Mega Buster was one that's just unlocked at the beginning of the game in an opening sequence. This is what I love about playing games that are released on Switch much later than everything else, is when they also include like all of this DLC stuff. And, like, the game opens and it's just dropping, like, this is unlocked, okay? This is unlocked, okay? This is unlocked, okay? In fact, poor Nico, in the very first segment, so she does this animation where she reaches under the counter and pulls out the newest thing she's invented. She had to do that 8 times in a row for all the stuff that, you know, after the first mission. And they just played the animation 8 different times. It didn't, like, you know, they didn't cut her a break on that one. So... yeah, I think it was 8 different times. I don't know. I should have recorded it, but it was so funny. So yeah, I guess it does come with that. There's also an optional in-game unlock bundle. So like there's some stuff that's like apparently really hard to get through normal gameplay, but you can get it.
Yeah, I think it's characters that you have to beat Dante Must Die mode to get.
Yeah, and then a 12 million red orb thing that you can get that's not necessary, but it's there. And then alt colors and a battle track 4-pack is what they call it, specifically for Virgil. But yeah, it's like, yeah, you can buy that for $10 extra as well. But yeah, I would definitely say, yeah, for the $40 and especially for the $30, this is a great opportunity for like Nintendo fans who didn't get to play this before to get in there. Because, you know, the other games did get released, but a little more quietly, I feel like.
Yeah.
This one, I guess, is a much bigger deal because it's something that couldn't run on Switch previously. So, indeed. Yeah, I give it a buy it.
All right. Next up, Monster Hunter Stories 3 Twisted Reflection, Rudy's Story. Developed, published, and provided to us by Capcom. Thank you, Capcom. Aki, say thank you.
Thank you.
Released June 25th as DLC for Monster Hunter Stories 3 for $9.99. A side story about Rudy, whose family have served as Azurian royal palicos for generations. One day, while accompanying the protagonist on a survey of some egg quartz, Rudy makes a surprising discovery. Aki, what is going on in Rudy's story?
Okay, so in this, they've added this to the actual main campaign. So you have to get about 60-ish% of the way through the game, thereabouts would be my guess. You have to get into the 3rd out of 4 major cities. And then you can access this as just one of the side character quests that every character has, except for Rudy until now. Basically, this ends up being...
The store page says it becomes available after playing through the first half of the game.
Yeah, I don't think it's the first half. There's four cities, and it's in the third city, so... And that's about 40 hours into this game, so... There's that to keep in mind. And basically, it involves Rudy, who is your little Palico royal attendant, which is a little cat guy. And he basically brings up that his family comes from a legendary individual who could control lightning and was amazing. And I'm pretty sure it's actually a Palico from one of the prior stories games, I believe, actually, is who it's supposed to be. And they end up finding information about his ancestor, and he goes out into the world with you to try and figure out everything that's going on, because he wants to understand this lightning power that he has that's not very strong in him. And it ends up being about four chapters. There's three boss fights, and it gives you a new outfit for Rudy, which ends up being his ancestor. Basically, you just turn him into his ancestor, because he gets all new voice as well to be that character. So you also get, I think, two new abilities that just gives your Rathos stronger attack and more critical damage or something like that. And yeah, it's a couple hours long. I don't want to go too into it, because if I go particularly any further, end up ruining what little story is there.
Yeah, it's a side story. It's not a full-on DLC, so.
Yeah, in side stories, every character has them. I don't think Rudy had any until now. And they're just, you know, for most of the characters, about every arc, they have a little side story, and it's typically like one quick little mission, and they get one basically every arc that you go through. So this is just him getting all of it all condensed into one area real quick. The boss fights can be a little difficult, especially the last one. So, yeah, you might want to start it once you get access to it, and then maybe finish it when you've gotten closer to beating the game, because that the last boss is
Buffy. All right, well, the DLC clocks in at $10, or it is also part of the deluxe edition and the deluxe kit for $10. What do you think of this?
I think it's pretty good. For $10, you get a couple new items, you get a little bit of story, you get a new outfit, and a new ability. I forgot about that. There's an item donut that you get, and it basically allows you to destroy stuff, like parts on creatures, more easily, which is awesome. So yeah, I think it's totally worth that, but I think the better idea is to get the deluxe edition, because then you get a bunch of really cool outfits for the other characters and stuff as well, and maybe more DLC in the future. I'm not entirely sure what all is added with the deluxe.
I don't know if any other DLC is coming with the deluxe kit. The deluxe is $25. It includes the $10 side story and then the other costumes that she mentioned. I don't think there's any other content coming to it. I would imagine any other content coming will be a full-on expansion.
Ah, okay.
Because they've done those for like maybe $30 or something. That's my guess.
Yeah, I would probably suggest just get the deluxe edition or the deluxe upgrade if you already have the game. Because those outfits, they're really good. I don't think any of my characters are actually wearing their original in-game outfit. I think all of them are wearing DLC outfits.
Because they look
that damn good.
Nice.
So, yeah.
All right, next up, Zaxxoid, developed and published by M80 Games. It released July 3rd, Xbox One, Series X and S, PS4, PS5, $14.99. Face an alien onslaught in Zaxxoid, an adrenaline-inducing twin-stick mayhem shooter. Defend the galaxy from relentless invaders by upgrading your ship or fortifying your city with strategic choices that make every run unique. Wield dual joysticks for precision chaos, transform into tank mode to repel surface invasions, and protect your population during intense gameplay that takes you back to the golden years of gaming. Purnell, tell us about your time with Zaxxoid.
So, we're off the cuff, I'm going to say, if you're familiar with an old chestnut called Super Stardust HD, you already know what you're getting here, and you probably already made your decision on if you want this or not. If you are not familiar with Super Stardust HD, well, this is a game where you are taking control of a ship and battling atop a multitude of spheroids to defend a city that is nestled atop each one. These spheroids have various properties that are unique to their individual planets. So in that regard, that will factor in largely into what you're doing on that level, in addition to the types of enemies and the quantity of them. So this game takes place over a series of waves. Before you even get into that, first thing you have to do is choose a pilot or the mode. There's classic mode, which involves you unlocking content and items. And there's arcade mode, which, from what I can tell, also from the description that it gives, just lets you utilize everything all at one time. I didn't do a ton with arcade mode because, to me, classic stood out, so I focused my time on that. So, after choosing classic mode, you choose your ship. And after all sets, you only have one character available, but you could unlock more as you progress through the game. And then lastly, you have to choose a spheroid to battle on. Just like what I said before, you start with one, others unlock as you progress. And once you choose a spheroid, well then guess what? It is time to get down to business. Well, after choosing some mods that you've unlocked as well, which should also affect your performance. But now I'm finally done, recapping, and I'm going to talk about the game itself. You're officially now on the planet. You officially have your ship, and there's a city you need to defend. And Wave 1 has begun. Wave 1, and every subsequent raid, mind you, enemies will descend from the sky as you're swirling around the spheroid, and they will engage you in some capacity, all in attempts to kill you, by spawning around the spheroid and attacking. As you move, the sphere kind of scrolls with you, so you're always at the top of the screen, or looking down on yourself from the top of the spheroid. And as you move, the spheroid will spin, which means you can't see the entirety of the map at any given point in time ever. So it means you got to stay on the move. You have a basic controller option where you use your left thumbstick to move your ship, the right thumbstick to aim your gun and also fire it. Left trigger basically lets you do like a dash attack. And there's also a button that lets you configure and utilize smart bombs, screen killing weaponry and the like. Every time you kill an enemy, you get experience points that drop from enemies, and it actually serves two purposes for you as the player. One, as you get it, you will eventually get to the point where you will level up your ship. You'll get experience points allowing you to level up. Now, unlike a lot of games of this ilk, you don't just level up once the experience points are reached. Instead, you kind of bank the actual rewards until you revisit the main city that you're protecting and utilize the menu features there to use all the access all the upgrades you acquired. And those upgrades can be anything ranging from increasing the power and functionality of your main gun or the missile associated with your ship, in which each ship has their own blaster and missile types, and a variety of other benefits and upgrades to your gun, ranging from common to rare and ultra rare. The next thing that happens, though, once you do that, is you gain access to what is essentially a menu of upgrades you can provide to the city you're protecting itself so that it can better defend itself and also assist you. Like, you might want to, say, for example, set up some cannons that they can fire at enemies that are approaching and attacking you on the surface. Or you might buy a shield that can further protect the city itself. There's also power plants you can build because certain things require you to have a certain number of power plants constructed in order to actually utilize such things. So suffice to say, you'll want to engage power plants sooner rather than later. But this happens during any wave. There's no break period here, though admittedly, once you go into the menu itself, it does give you time to shop and it does stop the action there. But there is no wave complete upgrade ship. It is, I need to upgrade. I'm going to fly to the base while everything's happening and take care of business. But then after you kill all the enemies on the screen, another wave will begin with no downtime. and it is back to business. Every once in a while, a wave might actually make it so that, I think as you mentioned at the beginning of the description, rather than you be flying your ship, it'll transform your ship into a tank, and there will be ground units that will be approaching the city or you trying to kill you. And the gun controls and all that are pretty much the same, except as a tank, I'm not really sure what the real difference is. I guess you feel a little heavier. Like, movement isn't as, quick, because you still get the dash function and all that stuff. It's just, you're a tank, and the enemies are different. Either way, it's not a bad thing. I don't mind it one bit, but it just seems like a weird difference, because it's not as big of a difference as I would have liked it to have been, given the change in controls. It almost feels like what Star Fox would have been if it was a spheroid instead of a 3D rail. So, now, with that said, I will say that during the tank scenario, every once in a while, there will be cargo drops that will get dropped on the planet, and you'll be tasked with finding them for extra bonuses to support your mission. Like, you might blow them up, and it'll just, like, pods open up will be, provide you further support on the missions itself. But long story short, you'll go through that process. Bunch of waves will happen. Bunch of items will be picked up, and upgrades will be attained, eventually culminating with a boss on the final wave. Beat that boss, you'll get a ranking and a score for the level, and you will wrap up your play. You do obtain currency from the play, which can be used in the factory area of the game's main menu to purchase unlocks that you have the access to acquire. That can include new pilots and ships or new upgrade items in the menu, both for the city or for yourself, and so on. And it's a pretty straightforward and simple loop, though I will say the difficulty can ramp up pretty fast. The first level is a tutorial, the second level is like a rank 1 difficulty planet, and funny enough, the third planet is a rank 3 difficulty. It jumps rank 2 and goes right to rank 3, and I got killed multiple times before I got lucky with a very particular run of items that let me just kind of engage the chaos, as it were, to make my survival happen. But I do feel like each planet has enough different about it that makes you feel like it's worth checking out each one individually, whether it's the difficulty itself or the level gimmicks that associate themselves with it. The gameplay is fast, furious, and fun. You can get lost in the chaos from time to time, I will admit. To be frank, I'm not sure if it's my brain going and opening up its third eye and making me get through those sections, or if I'm just getting really lucky and just blindly getting stupid with it, but it gets crazy on these levels sometimes. But it's fun to play, and I think you'll enjoy it too. If you like twin-stick shooters, if you like Super Stardust HD, if you like Challenge, if you like that one more run feeling, I think this game is for you, and it's well worth your time and energy.
Very good. Clocks in at $15. Your official verdict?
It is a buy. Definitely a buy. And very I good. Swear, I'm really wishing I had this energy with R-Type, the R-Type review now. God damn it. Because I still want to say more about it. But it's I digress. Okay. I don't know how I feel about that. I didn't even mention the going right. You go right.
Oh, well. One last game to talk about tonight, and that is some DLC for Blood West, with Blood West Scavengers, developed by Hyper Strange, published by New Blood Interactive. Released June 3rd is DLC for Blood West for $4.99. Blood West Scavengers brings the long-awaited endless roguelite mode to Blood West. See how long you could survive as you meet familiar friends and old foes in the never-ending weird Wild West. Horror Acolyte, tell us about your time with Blood West Scavengers.
Okay, so Blood West is a first-person stealth shooter set during the Wild West with a pretty big focus on being an immersive experience. I reviewed the base game for this on episode 1089 of the show, if you're interested in hearing a more detailed description of the base game and my thoughts on it. Spoilers, I did give it a buy-it rating. This review will be more specifically, as mentioned, for the Scavengers DLC, which takes the base game content, morphs it into a roguelite format. For those completely unfamiliar with the base game and how it plays, you're essentially an infamous gunslinger who dies and his soul has been contracted to help purge corruption that swept the land. And the base game is divided into three main chapters and has you exploring each of these areas to dispose of monstrosities that lurk there, like ghouls, crazed cultists, or wendigos. There's a fairly big focus on stealth in the game, combined with a stamina system for running and using melee weapons. Essentially, it's going about killing a bunch of enemies to gain experience, level up your character with more perks, while also exploring to help increase your arsenal of tools to slaughter more enemies, and also find equipable artifacts to enhance your character. And the map sections in the game are fairly large, and you're kind of free to explore them however you like, whatever methodology you want to use to get around. But so before I start in the Scavengers DLC, I should also note that I didn't end up beating this yet. I put a decent amount of time into it, but most of my runs have ended a little prematurely for me getting a little greedy, especially with one type of mission in the game that I'll kind of mention a little later on. So much like the base game, there are three difficulties to play this on: story, normal, and the hard mode, which I forget the name of at the moment. There are 8 total characters to choose from, 6 of which are unlocked from the beginning. For example, there's like a mobster guy, starts with like a revolver, a knife, and some bandages, and alcohol, and a small amount of money. It's like $150, I think. Or there's like a priest character with crossbow and bandages and some cash as well. Each character also starts with 1 perk leveled up on the perk tree. There's not really too much variance between them, other than their starting outputs, to my knowledge. Other than that, they also get some quippy lines when performing certain actions, like killing monsters. You start out in a main hub area that you return to between missions. This starting hub has a person named Joy, who runs the tavern, and she sells you supplies and gives you missions at the start. You can buy weapons, ammo, consumables, and artifacts from her, with the shop being refreshed between visits. There's also some slight randomization to what is offered, but it's within like a certain, I think, preset amount of available items. I think they might change a little bit the more you progress, but I wasn't 100% sure. It might just be pure randomization, though. As mentioned, she also offers you the missions. There's 3 missions to choose from at each point in time. They vary in money and experience earned. Missions include finding larger enemies to kill, or more challenging enemies on each map. Hunting down specific groups of enemies, or a supply stash. There isn't really many other mission types, at least that I got to see. Each mission can also come with kind of like bonus missions that act as modifiers to the mission almost. They can increase the amount of experience and money earned. Enhance the amount of experience and money earned the more of them that are active. I think there can only be 2 active at a time, though. Like having enemies be stronger, larger frequency of enemies, decreased mission time overall. Or the one that kind of got me into a bunch of awkward situations was the glass cannon modifier, which sets all the enemy HPs to 1, but they essentially deal 1,000 more percent damage to you, so it's pretty much one shot, you're dead as well.
Oh, jeez.
And you make more noise too, which is not ideal in a stealth situation, but that's usually where all my runs ended, was getting greedy with that modifier. The missions can end up being available across all the 3 main areas of the base game, so it'll tell you which location you're going to for the mission set. And they might be different for each one. It generally starts out with just the canyon area, which is like the starting area of the base game, and then it'll cycle in the other 2 areas as well that were in the base game. The more days you survive in this, which is essentially after you complete a mission, is like the cycle of 1 day. The more days you survive, the more permanent unlocks you get. These come in the form of like additional vendors that will have. They offer you the same types of missions, but this gives you a wider selection in terms of choosing which modifiers you want to tackle on a particular area. And aside from more vendors, you also get potentially like an increased stash amount in between missions. There's like a little stash you can use. That doesn't offer much space to start, but it can be increased the more days you survive. And when you go on a mission, there's random points of interest on the map. These I didn't spend too much time going towards, but for example, they kind of offer like small changes to the map itself, like in terms of the visuals. There's a saloon in the one area that if it acts as a point of interest in that particular mission, there was like bones scattered around it, and then there's like a corpse sitting on a or tied to a device kind of outside, just like hung up there, and that it made it way more creepy, which I liked. But yeah, I didn't see too many of the points of interest to know how much variance there is between them. I think I only really saw that one, and then there was like a spirit one that had a bunch of spirit portals. I still don't know what those are for, but yeah, so I don't know exactly what those do, but there is no displayed timer for the missions, at least not that I saw. So if you spend too long on a mission, you'll get a notification that the sun's about to rise, and once that displays, you kind of have to hurry back to your horse to end the day, or these flaming skulls will start spawning in, and they'll constantly attack you. And I don't know if there's, if you can just technically still spend the time there, if there's like at a point where you just like die, but usually I got out when it got to that phase, although I did have one instance where I had a bunch of flaming skulls I had to avoid, but I'm not sure if they just eventually spawn so many that you can't avoid them, or what the deal was, if you can just die outright. But yeah, other than that, you can find these figurines on the missions. They'll just kind of spawn randomly on the map, and if you bring them back from a successful mission to your room, not even a successful mission, if you survive the day, I think, and bring them back, they give you kind of nominal benefits, or they act as permanent upgrades between runs. So these are like 5% increased melee damage, or like 10 extra health or stamina points. It's all very like small incremental things, which don't really, they don't feel super impactful right away, especially if you just got a couple of them. But once you get a good portion, like I don't know if it's a noticeable difference, but it helps a little. If a character ends up dying, you respawn at the tavern on day one. So this is where the roguelite portion of the game comes into play, having lost everything you were carrying and all the money you earned. However, there's some permanent unlocks, as I mentioned, like the figurines I just talked about, and the more days you survived, the more vendors you have access to, which offer you better weapons and supplies, or more variants and supplies in general. And on each map, too, there's also some special doors you can unlock that I don't want to... There isn't much to spoil in this game, but I don't want to spoil like the little bit that is there, I guess. But once these doors are opened, they generally have like a little bit of loot in them, usually like a special artifact as well. And they stay open if you open them on a mission. So as long as you find out the key to open them and figure out how to open them, then that'll kind of be permanent progress on the maps. Other than that, though, I don't think there was any other progress that carried over on the maps themselves between runs. You also can't choose the same character on your next run, so if you die with a character, you do have to wait a run to choose them again, which is kind of awkward, because if you just really want to play as them, you can just go back on a mission, die, then restart and choose the other guy again. But so it seems like a waste of time. I don't know why they implemented it that way. There's also a couple of new weapons in this one. There's a rifle that starts out dealing a massive amount of damage, but the damage lowers each day you've owned it. So once the first few days you get it, it's like really, really good. But if you get it like really early on in your run, then yeah, it's a little unfortunate, I guess. Or I don't think there's a... I don't know if how it works. I don't know if you can store that weapon in your stash. I never tried that, but I wonder how it would work with that. I assume it'd start out as the same on day one. Then it actually would be kind of bad to have it on the first day. Anyways, there's also special weapons I noticed too. Like there's one called the Pounder, which I don't think was in the base game. It has a higher chance of a critical hit each day you own it, so it gets better over time. But it also increases the amount of recoil, I believe, as well per day. And, yeah, other than that, the only thing that really changed up in this was some of the artifacts. I don't know if there was any new artifacts, but some of the old ones that were in the base game, they make it so they're kind of locked, and you have to find not only the artifact itself, but also some powders. There's like three different colored powders, and you need to find a certain combination of those to be able to unlock the ability of the artifact. And usually these are like the more powerful ones, whereas some of the other artifacts are just available to use right away, and you can equip them. And then these ones you kind of got to unlock a bit. So it wasn't generally like some missions, I wouldn't find one color powder at all between like 5 or 6 days of searching, and that's like with some pretty steady searching on the maps. So it can be a little tricky to unlock them. Or you might get lucky. There's sometimes where I found an abundance of one color, but again, not one of the another color, so it gets a little awkward that way, I suppose. Although I can't remember if you can buy the powders from the vendors at all at any point. I never really tried to, but yeah, other than that,
speaking of buying things, this DLC clocks in at $5. Does the shop sell this for $5?
What the what?
Does the shop in the game sell its own DLC? That'd be funny.
No, it is.
How meta would that be if you could just buy the DLC in the DLC?
that would be something.
Yeah, I'm tired. Yeah, $5. What do you think of this?
I mean, all this game really does, in my opinion, it is recycle pretty much the base game, but like I said, in a roguelite format, it doesn't really. I didn't see really any new enemies unless they kind of appear later on in the runs. There's like a couple new weapons and stuff, but honestly, I was a little disappointed with this so far, unless it gets like really good once you get really deep into it, and I just maybe haven't gone to that point, but it didn't look like it was going to change much. I mean, I feel like this DLC should have been free, personally. It's not like a story enhancement DLC, like I forget the name of the other one that came out, The Dead Man's Curse or whatever it's called. Like, that was actually like a decent DLC. But it's at a price where it's almost like, fuck it, why not? If you like this game, it just, I guess, really hinges on whether you like roguelike gameplay formats, because all it really does is shift the base game into that. Like, it doesn't really add anything substantial, in my opinion. It's kind of a fuck it, why not, I guess. But, like, there isn't really that much here, in my opinion. Yeah.
All right. Well, with that, we are done. That is it for this episode. Music for this episode, since I mentioned Guitar Man, I'm just going to play another Guitar Man song. I mean, I don't need a lot of reasons to do it.
No, not really. No.
So yeah, big thanks to all four of you for being here, hanging out, keeping me company the whole time. Anybody have any final words to wrap this up?
Physical forever.
Unless you can't afford it.
Physical sometimes.